But what you're outlining seems like a fairly elaborate kind of suicide.
What happened? I should have known what I was doing. I should not have gone there. I really expected to meet my disaster or my end somewhere. Oh. Well, as people have said to me, if you don't want to live, why don't you do something about it?
Anne Gash, a woman who sailed a plywood boat around the world. The only way to live in retirement, according to her. Hello, Anne Jones here with Off Track on RN, with two stories that could almost come out of a boys' and girls' own adventure manual. Those who sail have a unique and very personal connection to their vessel that those who don't sail find very hard to fathom. They love it, they talk to it, they refer to it as a person. But it's not like a car, it's almost a biological connection, more tinged with life and death. Let me tell you a story. It starts in a shed, boiling in the summer sun, in Adelaide 35 years ago. A man called Michael Rossiter has an idea that he might build a boat. So he moulds the hull over many layers of steel mesh and concrete composite. Now this makes for a sturdy hull, but a damn heavy boat. It ends up being about 18 tonnes displacement. It took him 30 years to finish the boat, and he christened it Athena. Which brings us to Australia Day weekend, 2012. Rossiter set sail in his concrete yacht from the Royal South Australian Yacht Squadron in Adelaide to head to Stansbury, a small fishing town up the Gulf St Vincent. Rossiter himself can take over from here, followed closely by fellow Yacht Squadron member Dwayne Turpin. And then, as the weather closes in, you'll find out who saves who.
On Friday, we had a slow start across the Gulf and we lost time due to very little wind, but we later picked it up and made good progress. At the Stansbury end, there's a light beacon which marks the northern end of the sand spit. We gave this a wide berth to port before turning southerly into the Stansbury jetty. We had to drop sail and motored against a strong wind all the way down to Stansbury, arriving close to dusk. We anchored just off the end of the jetty in about 3 metres of water, and I laid out 30 metres of chain. At Stansbury, the anchor holding is mostly poor, with extensive weed patches and a thin layer of sand covering a limestone substrate. I was very conscious, therefore, of the necessity to check how well we were anchored for the night. And this is a story about anchoring. Now, the weather was pleasant, with a blue sky down our side of the Gulf, that is, the Stansbury side, and cloud could be seen over the Adelaide side. At about maybe 8:15, the wind started picking up. We jumped into our rubber dinghy and headed off for Athena. As we reached Athena, we just had time to climb aboard as the first large gusts of wind hit us. I was holding the dinghy painter as the dinghy lifted its bow out of the water, but like a Concorde, and literally stood on its outboard motor. I fastened the dinghy to our starboard entry gate and left it to look after itself. We had been hit by a fresh to strong gale force wind with speeds recorded up to 42 knots.
And this front came through and it was well over 40 knots, and normally if you get a squall it lasts 5-10 minutes. After about 20 minutes, I said, we've got to get back to the boat because the seas had built up so bad that it was pretty well dangerous to get back to the boat. And we just sat in the floor of the dinghy in probably a 3 foot plus choppy swell, which was breaking, and we got back to our boat. But on the way back, we saw Michael dragging. Basically, his anchor wasn't grabbing hold of anything, it was just grabbing weed. And the more weed you get around an anchor, the less chance it's got of digging into the sand. So pretty well that's what happened. And
we received radio advice to start our diesel engine and put out to sea. I remember being in the cockpit with one hand operating the anchor winch, the other controlling the engine's throttle and ship's wheel as I attempted to steer towards the anchor and bring in the chain. It was now dark and I was not able to see. Nor was I aware that, as I wound in the anchor chain and attempted to move the boat forward, that the anchor was in fact slipping and we must have been moving backwards. All of a sudden, I looked astern and saw a black cliff looming over us.
I actually thought, well, his ear was out further than us, and I said to the others, I'm sure he'll be all right because he's on board his boat. And next thing we knew, he was pretty well on the hard and big swell, and it was just on dark.
I redoubled my efforts on the engine, but to no avail. For a moment later, we felt Athena bumping aground. Another last burst of engine power was without effect, and the boat started to list with Athena's starboard side positioned towards the cliff. At this moment, I knew that all further efforts to recover flotation were pointless. At the same time, we saw that there was a police car now on the cliff top with its headlights shining out over the water above us.
I activated the red and blue lights of the police vehicle to alert the persons on board that police had been notified. My official name is Brevet Sergeant Wardale, officer in charge of Stansbury Police Station, but everyone knows me as Bluey. Well, I was just on normal patrol on Saturday the 28th of January, and about 7 p.m. that night, I was alerted to a vessel in distress. I went down towards the cliff face where there's a parking area, and by the time I got there, the vessel had beached itself right up against the cliffs, and they were just waiting, distressed to a degree because of the weather conditions, for help to arrive.
By now, the boat was listing to starboard so that pots and pans and other things were falling everywhere. All of a sudden, a dinghy appeared alongside Athena.
Well, initially, one of their colleagues in another vessel that was moored in Oyster Bay, he went over to this vessel, which was named Athena.
It was a colleague of ours, Dwayne Turpin of Thorfinn, who'd come to help us in dangerous sea conditions and in darkness.
There are only two other yachts and Michael's yacht. There were only four of us at the time. And I was contemplating leaving, getting out of there, because when the wind's up and you're on a lee shore, it's obviously dangerous. And I personally didn't really want to be leaving my boat on its own. I pretty well couldn't see their boat. I knew where it was, and I put a headlight on my head and told my wife to just keep an eye out for me when I was going, and I knew pretty well where they were and headed that way. There was a good chance I could have got tipped out of my dinghy, but I felt that I hopefully could have swum ashore. And so I jumped in the dinghy, and I didn't actually put any clothing on except my shorts, because I thought if I do come out of the dinghy, I'd be able to swim ashore, and I didn't want to be weighted down with wet weather gear. So I just went over in my shorts and singlet and put a life jacket on. It was pretty dark and choppy. It was pretty hairy to be out there in a dinghy and that. Probably on a scale of 1 to 10, it would have been, you know, as far as rough water and for a dinghy goes, it'd be close to a 10. And then I just sat as low and as forward as I could in my dinghy, and the waves were slamming against Michael's boat. It was up pretty well close to nearly 45 degrees, felt like, and bouncing around, and because of their age and maybe inexperience, they were all in a bit of a panic, I think. And I got on board and basically told them they had to abandon ship.
We donned our personal flotation devices and, on Dwayne's suggestion, grabbed the flares in case needed. Having done as much as we could do for Athena, we descended into the two rubber dinghies.
Basically told them to sit in the floor as low as possible, and I got them back to the boat ramp where the police were waiting for us.
And he, with his rubber ducky, got the three persons on board and conveyed them safely back to the Stansford boat ramp.
It wasn't an easy decision to make, and I've never been put in that. But, you know, I was going to head out, and I suppose you tend to play it down. But it wasn't easy for me to leave my boat at that time, but I knew that if I didn't go, there wasn't anyone else that was going to be there to help them if they needed help.
We rose at 5 a.m. the following morning to assess the situation with Athena before high tide. Athena had survived the night on her own and was where we had left her. She had a slight list still, but the tide was coming in. We got ourselves aboard as early as possible to assess the damage. I pulled up the floors and carried out a quick survey, which showed no holes and no water. I turned on the electrics and everything came on. I placed the ignition key in the lock and with some trepidation turned it. The engine started as if nothing had happened. It was now that things started to happen that I could not have imagined during the long night. Two power boats appeared as if from nowhere.
Tide was running out. That was the problem. It would have been high water between 6 and 7 o'clock. By the time we got all our gear ready, we were about 40 minutes late, and I thought, well, it didn't look good. I knew we were in trouble. Any longer than half an hour, she was all over, you know. Andrew Pisani here, commercial fisherman, Stansbury, and got a phone call. 7 o'clock in the morning, so we ended up getting the vessel Courage and heading out down the boat ramp and seeing the big yacht up on the beach, and it didn't look too good. Yeah, it was laying down on the starboard side and it didn't look too flash. I thought we have to try to roll it right over to get the keel off up off the bottom and try to run it on its belly. I was quite shocked. I didn't think we were going to get it off at all. I thought she was there to stay there, but I was quite surprised because in that area there's a lot of rocks, and it didn't look good because with that wind over that night from the east blowing that yacht up on the beach, I thought she would have been pretty well scathed.
A very substantial tow rope was passed from Skeet Pisani on his powerful boat Courage.
It's a 32-foot Clayton, and it's a big snapper boat. It's got two big outboards on the back, so it's 350 horsepower. So what we done was throw a massive tow line,
which was taken by Dwayne through our fair lead on the front of the boat and onto Athena's equally substantial bow cleat. Courage worked and pulled Athena's bow to a point away from the cliff. But she was still hard and fast.
There's a big boulder just down there in the water. It's about 200 metres off the low water mark. It was inside that there, and the water was just a bit higher than what it is now. And she was very high and dry. Another hour on the ebb tide, it would have been in a lot of trouble. Because the water goes out to like dry. All that, where that weed line is there, that'll be dry in the next hour or so. But the spit that runs right out there, out of the Black Beacon, that's all dry.
Turned around, but it wouldn't budge after that. And I said, mate, you realise it's over 20 tonne. And he said, oh, it's concrete. I'm like, yeah, you're not going to pull it off like that.
When I heard it was cement, I thought, well, here we go. But it's what it was. Like, the back of the boat was high and dry, virtually up on the rocks. So we ended up getting the another boat, a smaller vessel, and tying a rope to the top of the mast and rolling the boat right over one side. And we just, over about 20-odd minutes, trying to pull the boat off the beach.
Using the spinnaker halyard from the top of the mast so as to lift her deep keel off the ground as Courage powered ahead.
Yeah, I was very happy the way the outboards pulled the boat off the beach. I was quite surprised at the amount of grunt, the amount of horsepower it really give it, because it was a fair bit of... I had to really give them as much as I could to get it off.
Awesome. It was probably better than the drags, listening to Courage. It's awesome.
Suddenly I felt a rumble underfoot and Athena was being dragged off the ground and back into deep water. All of a sudden she was afloat. A lone observer up on the cliff could be heard to cheer and clap, as did we.
When the boat came free, I was very surprised. It just overcome. As soon as we got under that metre and a half of water, it was just, yeah, your heart was just, thank God for that. It was great, you know what I mean? And I think the bloke who owned the boat, he was pretty relaxed after once it all got off.
And especially with the assistance of the local fisherman, Andrew Pisani, retrieving the boat in the morning, it all ended up... very good, and they sailed off into the sunrise back towards Adelaide.
I didn't realise, talking to the bloke a few days later, that he ended up building that boat over 30 years by himself. So fair bit of effort what he's done. So he's definitely his pride and joy. To see on his face was just unreal. You know, he was very, very worried. When I got there, it was like, yeah, it was. He couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe it at all.
Andrew Pisani, a commercial fisherman from Stansbury with a powerful boat called Courage, finishing off this episode's first adventure. You're listening to Off Track. I'm Anne Jones, and this is RN. It was the early 70s when a woman from Sydney decided she might like to try sailing. Her name was Anne Gash, and after a couple of years sailing on the weekends, she decided to sail around the world in a plywood boat. She wanted to attend a flute summer school in Britain, and this seemed like as good a way as any to get there. She was interviewed by Steve Kosser in 1980 for an ABC program called City Extra. Here's an edited version of that interview.
The only plan I had, the only goal I had, was to try and reach England for the International Summer School of the Pipers Guild there so that I could play my music with the group of people. That was my goal. I made it by the skin of my teeth.
Did you?
Yes.
You've had some unpleasant experiences, though, when you've gone ashore. I'm thinking particularly of Accra.
Oh, well, I should have known what I was doing. I should not have gone there. Sailors don't go there. There was only one other yacht that I've read about that ever went there. That was a very big sort of ship with a huge motor and a lot of money probably in the man's purse. But that's an experience that I have paid for. When I arrived in Accra, I went ashore and found my family, stayed with them in their air-conditioned house. Now, this is something I hadn't done before. I'd never left the yacht. The Ghanaians entered the yacht and stripped her of everything of any value And to replace these things was difficult because in Accra there's virtually nothing. I was lucky enough to have a sextant loaned me, and I got a tin clock, a kitchen clock rather, from a supermarket or a kind of supermarket there, and I was ready to go when a tug working nearby the yacht slammed her against a jetty and damaged a lot of the interior woodwork, and there was no way I could leave. So when that was repaired, the man had called Peter who helped me. He helped me because he'd built a yacht exactly the same as mine, a folk boat, and sent it to England on a ship, and he helped me repair it. Now, because he hadn't sailed his boat, I waited a few more days so he was free to come for a sail. On the morning of the day we were going for a sail, there was a short, sudden line squall storm over the harbour, and my little boat was really damaged all down the side, and the rail was busted, and the rigging was damaged, and I thought I was going to lose her, really. That was a really very bad experience. But no matter what happened, I was going to do everything I could to save her. And there were onlookers by the hundreds, and not one of them thought to come on the yacht and try and help me save her from the buffeting that she was receiving every time the waves threw her against the side of a ship. We repaired all that, and I tried to sail away, but I was so much later than I had really intended to be there that I met stronger currents, and a lot of rain fell in the yacht, and the weather patterns were unstable. There was heavy rain, heavy wind, no wind whatever, big swells, and food went bad, and all sort of things went wrong, and I knew I was just going to get lost, and I thought that I owed it to everybody to come back to port. And I did that. I took 3 weeks to sail 330 miles and about 3 days to get back to port because the currents, of course, aided me. And then I found a ship and I managed to get to England.
So your boat, in fact, was piggybacked all the way to England?
Just that, yes, for 30 days. It was a Ghanaian ship. I was the only white woman on board. All sorts of experience were happening. I didn't exactly lock my bedroom door, but I put the chain on it because it was marvellous how many fellows wanted to be companionable at night.
On that long trip to England. What about the cost of all of this? Was that a problem for you throughout the period?
Well, you're really hitting the nail on the head a little bit there. I'm afraid I didn't have the wherewithal to ever settle myself in anything where I could live to old age comfortably with a bit of land to grow a few foods and things, that even if I worked and borrowed money, I'd never had enough working years to pay off a substantial loan, and I couldn't really see my way to ever getting this kind of secure old age future. So I'm afraid that I sort of threw my cares to the wind and piled everything into this little yacht. I really must tell you, Steve, I didn't expect to come back. I really expected to meet my disaster or my end somewhere. Well, I didn't meet it, and I am back. And I'm really back in the throes of all the things I went away from.
But if you thought like that, why did you go?
Well, because there's nothing I could do about it, that I could see that I could do about it.
But you didn't have to go.
Well, I was kind of running away, too, from a lot of things that I think ought to be changed, and yet I'm not the one to get on the soapbox and try to change them. Because I see a lot of mistakes and a lot of forward problems with the way we're living.
But what you're outlining seems like a fairly elaborate kind of suicide.
Oh. Well, as people have said to me, if you don't want to live, why don't you do something about it? But you have... Oh, no, there's no way you could do anything so negative as that, because after all, you're not just one person in the world. You're bound up with families and friends and in sort of interaction with other people that you must honour and have a little bit of moral feeling for, I think.
What did you feel when you came back and you did survive?
I wasn't very pleased to come back to Australia, actually, except that it was the end of a voyage and I needed some good fresh food. But, I was really preparing the yacht to go away again when I lost her, so that I can't explain all those feelings because I felt sort of with the ground cut from beneath me, or the sea.
We must stop referring to her as her or it.
Yes, Illimo.
It in fact has a name, Illimo.
Yes.
Which means what?
Illimo was a name I found in a walkabout magazine, and it's the name of a New Guinea coconut palm, one that more or less leans over the water, a little bit bent looking. So that was the name. I liked the runny sound of the name. On the time, there was a tune on the Alamo. And Alamo I liked, but I didn't like the A part of it. So when I saw Illimo, I thought, oh, that's the name I'm looking for. And I'm stuck with it ever since.
What was your relationship with that ship?
Oh, well, very hard to explain because, you see, everything that little yacht did, she did beautifully. She sailed beautifully. She sailed over these big waves beautifully. I managed the sail changes with not much effort, and she kept responding to everything that I wanted her to do, and I always found her so trustworthy.
Was she a kind of perfect person?
Oh, perfect, yes, yes. I think that might be a bit romantic, you know. She was only a lump of wood, really, wasn't she?
Did
you talk? I'm quite aware of that.
Did you have conversations with her at all?
I mean, oh, always. Oh, with me. Yes, I talked to me a lot.
Did you?
Yes.
Anne Gash wrote about her experiences sailing around the world in a book called A Star to Steer Her By, published in 1980. She was interviewed in that very same year by Steve Kosser for the ABC. Gash passed away in 2006, not losing herself on the seas, as she once might have thought, but rather to leukaemia. My name's Anne Jones, and after today's adventures on the sea in our beloved boats, you can be sure that next week here on Off Track, I'll take you somewhere else.